So what this really is at the end of the day, coming out now is about just stepping into and owning my inherent value, truly loving and owning what an incredible gift. And this is the final part of it, the incredible gift and blessing of what it is to be gay.
Welcome to Secret Life Podcast. I'm Breanne Davis-Gant. Mark and I are blown away by the tremendous support on the heels of our 150th episode. We're excited to welcome thousands of new subscribers and wanted to share a few of our past listener favorites. Thank you again for subscribing, favoriting, and sharing. Now sit back and enjoy the show. Welcome to the Secret Life Podcast. Tell me your secret. I'll tell you mine. The best way to support the show is to subscribe and share. If you haven't left a review or ratings on iTunes, please do. It helps more people find our show. And if you want to be on it, please shoot me a note at secretlifepodcast@icloud.com. Welcome to the Secret Life Podcast. I'm Breanne Davis-Gant. Today, I will be pulling back the curtains of all human secrets. You know, the ones we keep deep, deep inside that make us sick to our stomach and we're probably going to be buried with them, or those other secrets that are very embarrassing and silly, but we still don't tell anybody. You know, the how, what, when, where, why of it all. So today, my guest is Robert. Robert, dun, dun, dun. My question for you is,
yes.
What is your secret?
My secret is really what was my secret, probably the most seminal secret that I carried in my life, which was that I recognized at a very young age, though I didn't identify that way, which was that I was gay. Just sort of as a background notion, it was just something that I've come to realize it was perpetuated in my family and society and the world. And, and I've come to look back on it, you know, we'll circle back to kind of how it started, but is that it, you know, I now look at it as kind of a mental, emotional, and sometimes physical child abuse that children are brainwashed into thinking that there is something so wrong with them that there is just no place for them in the world. And that's how I felt. When I was really young,
how old were you? You think
so
when you first started feeling it?
So in first grade, I remember living at this. I had two neighbors, and after school in first grade, I would arrange to play tag with Johnny and Marissa. Mm-hmm. And Johnny was like a young athletic kid, and I was first grade, and Marissa clearly had a crush on me, and I was so drawn to him, and I didn't know what it was, but I devised this game of tag where the other person had to sit on the person that they caught, because that was the only way in that moment I could think of to have physical contact with him. Marissa was throwing herself at me, and I was throwing myself at Johnny, and I was in the first grade. And what's interesting is I knew then there was something something wrong. Or, and I think, I'm like, why did I think that? What was my, and I realized it was just that there was no one, it wasn't modeled anywhere in the world. The only examples in the world were just of male-female couplings. And so, I don't think it was that I inherently felt there was something wrong, because it's just pure and beautiful.
Yeah.
But there was just no example. And then it went on, I was trying to decide if it was like fourth or fifth grade. I remember standing in line, going to school, and some kid, I heard the word queer, and I felt myself seize up inside.
Really?
And yeah, and I just felt like, oh, that's bad. You know, that's when I really got, it's wrong, you have to hide. And I was already hiding. And so, during that time, I remember then in the years to come, I would pray to God nightly to make me normal. And I would define normal for God as being attracted to women. And right. I would pray for a pill, that could make me quote unquote normal as I saw it then. But I guess just to circle around, I really see coming out as a journey. I think, and there's many versions of coming out as there are people. you know, it's just this series of actions and occurrences and experiences that make up your own tapestry of coming out. And, you know, for me, when I first started to, you know, and it's easier for some than for others, you know, I was able to quote unquote pass, you know, I could sort of get by pretending. Some people don't have, it's apparent for whatever reason in the world that, you know, that they might have a sexual difference in that way. And so we all have different versions of, you know, what we have to deal with. And one of the things, again, to circle back around to the specifics, but one of the things that I have always been big on with respect to coming out and outing people is that we have compassion for everyone to have their own process, because we all grew up with different ideas about the extent to which it was right or wrong. And I had some really strong messaging in the home, which told me that I needed to hide.
So let's go back when you were a young kid, and you said something that I want to touch on, because I don't want to miss that moment. But you said when you heard the word queer, like that, there was like a pit in your stomach and you're like, oh, that is what I am. And I just had this feeling, because I haven't experienced that it just like hit me in my heart that to know you're different and the society not allowing it to be, how painful it had to be to hold that in. Because now I'm living my truth and I used to be inauthentic, and that was so painful. Yeah. And it's on such a deeper level that I could see why you'd want to hold that secret, but then it breaks my heart that you had to hold that secret at the same time.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny, it makes me, what was so compelling, just the sidebar when Pete Buttigieg was running, is he would often reference just wishing if there were any way that he could, and he said the language, that he could cut out that part of himself with a knife, he would have.
Yeah, because I would do that with my addiction and things I've done. Like if I could cut that part and not make it a part of me, I would in an instant. So I can't imagine my sexuality on top of it attached to that. Like want to get rid of that part of you when it clearly is who you authentically are.
Right.
Especially as a young child. I mean, where were you born? Yeah. You didn't even say where you were raised.
Yeah. Like, well, so Tampa, Florida. I was born and raised in Tampa, Florida. And, you know, the only reason I didn't think about cutting it out of me is that I'm not big on blood or knives.
So I'm not either.
I wanted a pill. I'm like, can you give me a pill, God, please? So it would be, you know, more painless. Cause avoid the pain. But, you know, so my first experience just, you know, so this coming out journey was, the first time I fooled around with someone was, my junior year, the end of my junior year was senior prom. I was going with a senior who'd asked me to prom, and we were with, you know, some other folks at a hotel after the prom. And I'd heard about this guy who was a linebacker on the football team.
Oh.
You know, I remember we were all sitting on this bed, and I, we were all drunk, and our two dates were chatting on the front of the bed. And I had my arm back behind the covers behind him. We were sitting against the backboard. And at some point, I just reached over and touched him. And he looked over at me. I don't know where I got the brazenness to do that. It was clearly, you know, in alcohol.
I kind of love it, though, a little bit.
And he
like,
looked
I'm
over
like,
at
yeah.
me, and I said, do you want me to stop? And he just shook his head and then looked back forward again. And so anyway, we made some excuse. We ended up, there was a fight on another floor with one of our mates. And so we made the excuse that we were going to go check on it. And then in the stairwell of the hotel, I had my first experience.
Oh, my God. My heart, literally, the romance in me is like, oh, they found each other in Tampa, Florida in a hotel.
In the stairwell.
Stairwell. That's like a movie.
The heartbreaking part of it, though, is it was against the backdrop and the underpinning of believing how wrong it was, you know, and how terrified of discovery. You know, it's like, you know, other people have their own sort of feelings in the world. Oh my gosh, trying to deal with just the insanity or the difficulty of expressing affection for another, you know, in a world where it's accepted. So that happened. You know, I had a few other experiences. I ended up, you know, going to, I had this whole, what's called it, like the best little boy in the world thing. And so I was always trying to, you know, sort of disprove this core thought that I had. I was the homecoming king, you know, in high school. I was in football. I did all these things that were about trying to disprove or to compensate for this thing that was, you know, at the core of me.
Well, also and, to like, that's the American standard of what a man is supposed to be, you know, yeah. All those things you just listed is what we have as like the ultimate man in America.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I continued that when I went to college. I got into, you know, a very classic fraternity that was all athletes. I was like the token a cappella guy. My whole fraternity was all lacrosse players and mostly lacrosse players, but also some wrestlers and baseball players and football players, but mostly lacrosse players and this one guy who sang in the a cappella group. but so important was it to me to, you know, that I was willing to put myself into a situation that I knew was you're like completely loaded with homophobia and these notions of what it meant to be a man, because I was trying so desperately to be accepted and to feel loved and to feel value where I didn't feel that. And so it was, you know, but I kept it hidden. I would sneak out and go downtown to bars. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention that at 16, I went to my first, I left a keg party, drove across town to this place where I'd seen guys sort of standing on corners, and there was this cinder block building. And I saw guys coming in and out of it. I sat for an hour in my car outside of this building, which was called the OP. It was a gay bar in Tampa, Florida, but there were no windows on it, which was so indicative of what a gay bar would be. It was completely clandestine. And I remember my heart just wanted coming out of my body the first time I walked in there, and the smoke-filled place, and you know, they.
How did that feel?
Terrifying and extraordinarily liberating to know, because I spent so much of my life thinking I was the only one like me, you know? And so this coming out process were these stages, you know? So that was a huge leap forward to realize that these guys who were standing on the side of the road, who were, I think, hustlers, actually, it turns out, you know, and me noticing and being with my mom and trying to put it all together and go, oh, wait, that there's something, you know, just to try to find those breadcrumbs and to follow that, you know. So anyway, that was a step. I met, you know, some folks in the community a little bit before I went off to college. That was a part of a coming out process. You know, the whole thing at school, I went to work in Fort Lauderdale over the summer before my senior year. And I met a guy named Wade, who became my first official boyfriend. And we were long distance my senior year. He came up then for, you know, senior week. And I guess I should say, I was, you know, always very scared of being found out. And there was National Coming Out Day, the latter part of my senior year. It was the most terrifying thing in the world. I wore a pink armband as a part of the, and I walked across campus, my heart just pounding out of my chest, you know, and some, you know, straight people did it as well. It was about being supportive, but
yeah, you know, but it was your pretty, truth. You were wearing your truth. Flag. Was that when you came out to your parents, or when did that happen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that one,
his face, just so you guys know, he's like, oh,
yeah. So that summer after my senior year, I was waiting to hear whether I was going to get into law school or not. Wade and I broke it off. And I was having a phone call with another friend that I had met up in New York, because I'd gone out to New York City for the first time. And, you know, again, this whole part of a process of going more into the community, becoming, again, part of the coming out process. And my mom was listening on the phone on the other line, because back in the day, you know, you would have multiple phones and you could listen on the other line. And so for several weeks, she said, you know, we really have to have a talk, son. We really have to have a talk. And then I was talking that night again to that same friend 2 weeks later, and I hung up the phone and she slammed the door open and just started yelling at me, saying, you know, I love you, mom, now, but at the time she was saying you're worse than a murderer or a rapist or anything else. And that was the way that I came out to my parents. It was this, her listening on the other line. You know, my first year of law school,
I mean, that has to be that moment of, you know, your mom throwing open the door, pretty much throwing open like your truth and opening you up and saying like, you're worse than a murderer. That moment for you had to be heartbreaking.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Brian, because you know, we often talk about the fact that we have our coming out process, but then our parents have their own.
Oh, definitely.
And so in that moment, I had been dealing with mine for a while, you know?
Oh,
so in a way, I kind of had, you know, you develop a skin, you develop a Teflon, you know, and granted, when it's your parent coming at you with those kind of things and the kids are always afraid of, getting kicked out of the house, whatever, you know, I remember thinking, thank God I'm about to leave, you know, because I don't know what would have happened, honestly, if I had had to stay under that roof for more than, you know, the month that was left of that summer before I went off. But it was horrible.
Yeah. It was horrible. Horrific.
But in some weird way, the other thing that had happened was I was buying into this idea that my value was less because of this thing about me at the time, you know? So her saying those things in some ways were like not that far off from what I felt about myself.
Oh, she was validating your true feeling of that worthlessness that you felt. Right.
Yeah. So it was horrible, you know, and because it was a secret and now it was no longer a secret, but there was a process of me starting to love and value myself because it just was so much an expression of what couldn't be denied, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I went to law school, I remember that whole first year, you know, I'd have these phone calls with her and I had a friend who was there and I would just hold the phone away from my ear and she was just stunned at the screaming, the nonstop screaming that came through the phone. Anyway, I ended up, you know, having some more boyfriends along the way. I met a guy up at the white party in New York, who became my first like long-term, you know, we were together for 5 years. I moved out to Los Angeles to be with him and it was beautiful in many ways. And I was still growing and evolving and you know, as was he. And, but so, you know,
but I do want to say, I do want to ask you this question before, because it has to go with the coming out, like holding that secret. I like to always look at the secret and look at the deadly seven sins of the secret. You know, it's a human, it's part of our human characteristics, these sins. I don't look at them as horrible. They're just part of human nature. So we got pride, greed, lust, gluttony, envy, anger, and sloth. When you were holding this secret, is any of those ring true to them, and why?
Two of them. Pride, because it was about how I looked. It was about wanting to fit in. It was all about, you know, wanting, and pride in reverse, really, because it was, you know, this sense of being, you know, valueless, you know, so trying to discount, to counter that idea. But it was all about, and which is interesting because we use the term pride, you know, and a true ownership of one's, you know, pride.
Right, right.
And the other was envy. I felt a deep, I mean, deep, deep, deep envy of straight people.
Yeah.
Because they got to be the thing that I so much wanted to be.
Right. And they just had it easier, and it was just an easier path.
They're just, you know, their ability to express love, didn't have to be fought for, you know, didn't have to be, you know, like, you didn't have to, like, you know, I used to write on bathroom walls in college because that was the way that we met people, because there was no internet, there was no nothing, like, we'd agree to meet at certain times. I mean, that was the nature of what it was.
And sometimes I just have to stay as a straight person. I'm like, shame on us straight people, like that. We shouldn't be allowed to share our love if not everybody's allowed to share their love. Like that actually makes me angry. I'm angry about that because it's not okay. Because love is love in whatever form it comes in. So I do want to hit like the moment your mother really, you know, accepted this, because I know you're close to her now. So moment?
Quickly, I should mention just a couple of the real quick things. You know, I remember, so I was out personally, but not professionally. I remember being on the set of Veronica's Closet and Kathy DeJimmy sort of sizing me up for Kirstie Alley to find out if I was available or gay or straight or whatever. I remember being backstage in Carolina the City and an actress on Valentine's Day saying, what are you doing tonight? Da, 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 you know, and so there was that ongoing
thing. Well, you're very handsome. I could see a woman being like, hey, so you want to like.
But it was a weird, there was a weird fear that went along with it. You know what I mean? Like I'm playing it off as if, oh yeah, da, 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 but I'm terrified inside. Like, what, are they going to figure it out? Anyway, so long story short, I ended up coming out on the cover of the Advocate magazine in 2002. Mm. So that was another stage of coming out. That's when I came out professionally. And
which is terrifying if, you know, in Hollywood. Terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there were many people, particularly at that time, there were not many, you know, people who were out, and very few in my kind of category as far as, you know, leading men-ish type guys or whatever, like almost none, really. And so it was and I had a lot of people say, don't do it. I had some who were encouraging. And I guess, you know, the other thing, just in terms of the coming out thing, could kind of bring it full circle, is that it continues to be an ongoing process, because I feel like even after you've done all of that, I feel like part of the coming out is the mental, emotional coming out, mm-hmm. is the deeper work that we do, that I do to just not hide, you know, right. to keep. I had to deal with the discomfort of watching people hold hands years after I'd come out, just because it would bring up a fear in me. You know, I would drop my voice when I used the word gay at tables. And so what this really is at the end of the day, coming out now is about just stepping into and owning my inherent value, truly loving and owning what an incredible gift. And this is the final part of it, the incredible gift and blessing of what it is to be gay. To actually see that the thing that I thought was so horrible is one of my greatest assets. And that is like, for me, the full circle that I think many of us are still trying to get to, and doing the inner work that we need to do to get to that place. And I'm in the middle of it myself. So,
well, so you know, on the straight side, we still have to do that work too. Like we all have these holes in us where, you know, we don't think we're good enough, or how we're made is not good enough. They're different. Yep. So I feel like for anyone to get to a place of really self-love and self-worth, you have to do the work.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And so I just want to hit these couple.
I never want to stop doing. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you have no choice at this point. Once you open that door to do that work, it's not like you can go backwards, because you know too much now.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
So who do you think this secret, you know, harmed or benefited holding it?
Well, I mean, look, I think in smaller ways, because thank goodness I was really the kind of person that was mindful about, you know, the way that other people could get hurt. And there were, you know, and there were a few women that I dated, you know, where I wasn't being honest. So it certainly affected them, but they were very, very short lived, and we never even, you know, became physical. Like I let it go a couple of dates and that was it. So it was minimal harm in that sense. You know, there were a lot of friendships. There were friends who say, it hurt me that you couldn't be honest. And I was trying to kind of, you know, I was just scared and trying to take care of myself and assuming that they were going to reject me. But then I remember a friend being angry with me, and I'm like, why are you angry? And she's like, you couldn't be honest with me. And I'm like, I had no idea.
You're like, I'm having trouble even doing it with myself, let alone you, you know?
But there was that. And I think, look, the biggest thing at the end is, of course, the harm to self. You know, I think that at the end of the day, and it's understandable. And again, that's why I'm so encouraging of everyone to have their own journey and process. And people get angry about people not coming out, you know, and I'm always on the side of like, no, you don't know what messaging they grew up with. You know, theirs may have been, you know, life or death messaging. I try to, you know, continue to have compassion around that. But yeah, I think that's the, you know, I'd have to think more about who else might have been harmed. But
well, how do you move forward in the future now? Now that you are working on your self-love and doing that inner work, you know, how are you moving forward in the future?
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things, you know, in the community, it's a common thing to use like drugs and alcohol to bring down the wall of being able to express, you know, Oscar Wilde called it the love that dare not speak its name, right? So it's this the secret. So to bring that wall down, to let that love express itself in connection, in intimacy, you know, in relation with another person of the same sex, you know, the attraction, it took that because there was this wall. And so a lot of the work now is I've been sober for 15 years off drugs and alcohol. And so a lot of the work is about trying to be able to really open and relate intimately, you know, in the absence of substances, and just to keep going deeper in that. And to try to be gentle with myself as I realize that I do it, you know, born out of this sort of place of dysfunction that was, you know, abroad. You know, I mean, we're still in a world where in 10 countries people can be put to death for being gay. So
it's crazy. That to me is crazy.
So today it's all in the background. Even if we're in a city where, you know, we feel like it's relatively, you know, it's all still in the, but anyway, so that's the work is just to keep, you know, where, how I move forward is just to keep, you know, learning how to love and express physically, intimately, you know, relationally, with as much honesty and love and compassion, self-compassion, you know, as I can.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. It was beautiful and I'm so grateful.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. I don't think I don't know that I've ever gotten to sort of really reflect back and talk, think so much about the journey of my particular journey of coming out. I've mentioned bits and pieces, but it was really a beautiful opportunity to think back on that. So. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to Secret Life Podcast. I'm Breanne Davis-Gant. If you have a past secret that you've gone through and on the other side, or in a present one where it's still buried inside of you and you want to be a guest, please message me below or email me at secretlifepodcast@icloud.com. Until next time. Thank you again for listening to Secret Life Podcast. Please subscribe, share, send me a note, and you can always support the show with a donation on our site, secretlifepodcast.com. Until next time, bye.
President Biden refused to negotiate on the debt ceiling.
I will not yield.
But Speaker McCarthy and the House forced Biden to cave, delivering another win for conservatives. Work requirements for welfare, unspent COVID money for China, clawed back. And for once, Washington will spend less than the year before. The House took on Biden and won. Call Congress at 800-894-2036. Tell them to support the conservative reforms. Paid for by American Action Network.
Mother's Day is almost here. And you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.